I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A warning. This episode contains language and depictions of violence that may be disturbing to some listeners.
Hello. This is a prepaid debit call from
Hassan.
Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, the Sunni Muslim leader or imam at Lucasville at the time of the 1993 uprising. The uprising, during which 10 people were killed and Keith Lamar was sent to death row for 5 of them.
Thank you for using GTL.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Thanks, consider I'm good.
Hassan, formerly known as Carlos Sanders, was convicted of various crimes that took place during the uprising and sentenced to death for his alleged role in the murder of Officer Robert Vallandigham. Hassan calls me from death row at the Ohio State Penitentiary, the same prison where Keith is. Thankfully, Hassan has agreed to speak with me about his story, his uprising, his case. I need to learn more about what happened back in 1993 from the man who was at the very center of it all. Is what transpired during those 11 brutal days what he intended? Are there any similarities in the investigation and prosecution of his case and Keith's? And does he have any insight into whether or not Keith was the actual leader of the so-called death squad?
I don't want to use all of your time today, so...
No, I set this time to decide for this purpose.
I'm Leah Rothman. This is The Real Killer. Episode 9, The Scapegoat. I asked Keith a while back if he and Hassan, or he and any of the others from Lucasville who are housed at the Ohio State Penitentiary, talk about their cases, compare notes, try to help each other. He said no. There's an unwritten rule about it. It's just not something you do. It's not something you talk about. So I have no idea how Hassan will react when I ask him about Keith, if he'll shut me down or be open to talking. So at first, I decide to tread lightly.
Did you know him before the uprising?
Yes and no. Not know him personally. I've seen him fight in the boxing ring because I used to box. I've seen him fight one day on yard in the boxing ring. And another time, I was walking with some Muslims who was going to chow, recreation yard or somewhere. And he had like some rosaries around his neck or some beads. And some of them fell off and he became discouraged and shook them off. And I was like, hold on, man. I said, don't become discouraged. Just pick them up. put him back home, you know. So me and some of the other Muslims picked him up and gave him to him. And once the riot happened and we ended up on death row together, I brought that up to him and he remembered that.
I plan to come back to the subject of Keith a bit later. Today, Hassan is 60, born and raised in Georgia. In 1978, at age 15, he was sent to a juvenile detention center for aggravated assault with intent to rob. He says while he was there, he escaped. So for that, he was tried as an adult and transferred to prison. Eventually, he was released and moved to Ohio in 1983. The next year, Hassan was convicted of aggravated robbery and sentenced 13 to 25 years. In April of 1988, at the age of 25, he was transferred to Lucasville.
Lucasville, it was very loud. People would be throwing urine, feces, bodily wastes on one another, throwing hot scalding coffee on one another's faces. It was like the OK Corral. It was just a wild environment. There was a lot of stabbing and murdering going on in institution, a lot of racism. There was a few black prisoners that was murdered by staff members.
Can you tell me a little bit about how Warden Tate ran the prison?
Okay, yes. Arthur Tate Jr., also known as King Arthur, they sent him there, and his job was to straighten out the problem. And not only with prisoners, but even with staff members. Staff members had become accustomed to a certain culture, and Tate, when he came, he didn't care whose toes that he actually stepped on, whether you were the inmate or whether you were an officer or a staff member. His position was, is this institution going to be run my way, or you can hit the highway?
And how did you become the imam at Lucasville?
My predecessor made his intention that he was going to step down from being the imam, which would be the spiritual leader and head of the Muslim community. And he said that he was handpicking me to be his successor.
That must have felt great that you were chosen.
No, absolutely not. To the contrary.
Really?
I didn't know, because a lot of prisoners who had a very aggressive and assaultive type behavior, they was now being transferred to Lucasville. And older people in Lucasville was now being moved out. So Lucasville used to be very a violent and abusive type environment. But now you got a lot of young people came in, and it's increased tremendously. So contrary to the popular opinion, no, I was not pleased to be appointed. But reluctantly, I did accept the position of becoming the spiritual head for the Muslims.
Before the uprising, where were you housed?
I was in the honor block, and you have to be a person that out of trouble, you can't be getting in trouble to be in the honor block. So I became more or less a model prisoner. Staying out of trouble, good work performance and behavior, and being enrolled in academical school, you get a good time credit. I was 1 year away from the parole board at the time of the Lucasville uprising.
In episode 2, we talked a lot about what happened in the days leading up to the uprising. Specifically, in regard to the TB test, Warden Arthur Tate planned to administer to those 159 men who had previously refused it. The Muslim community believed the test, which contained phenol, was a form of alcohol. And for them, being forced to consume alcohol was a violation of Islamic law and their religious freedoms. So the Muslim prisoners, led by Hassan, stood their ground. So did Warden Tate.
And I was telling him that just because a person comes to prison and the doors or gates are actually closed behind him, it does not forfeit prisoners of their constitutional rights. If you can use some other method, whether it be a chest x-ray, if a urinalysis would suffice, if that would work, I mean, we was fine with that. His position was he was not going to allow prisoners, in this particular case, Muslims, to dictate to him how he runs his institution.
On Easter Sunday, April 11th, the Muslim prisoners were determined to show Warden Tate who actually ran his institution. But Hassan says things did not go as planned. What you're about to hear is Hassan's behind-the-prison-wall account of what he says happened.
there was never intended to be an uprising, or as some people love to say, a riot to begin with. It's supposed to be a peaceful protest, you know, because our position was Tate coming in here, instituting all these rules. We felt if we could take over a certain place of a portion of the prison or one particular block and barricade ourselves in there and try to get the attention of the media and his superior and central office, that we can try to resolve the matter.
The plan was for it to be a nonviolent protest, right? But in order to barricade yourselves, like, you had to, like, you had to get the guards out of there, right? So was that part of the plan? I mean, because I think the first thing that people on the yard saw was like a guard running out with blood running down his head. I mean, you guys had to get control in order to barricade yourselves in, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are some people who may be submissive, there are some people who wouldn't be submissive. I can't say, because I was not part of why this particular, I don't know if it was one of the people who initially took over of the area, or just somebody seeing the opportunity that these officers are losing their post and just took opportunity to attack an officer. I don't know what the circumstances were, but yes, everyone knows that you have to have bargaining chips. If you have no bargaining chips, why would they allow you to just barricade yourself there if you got something to negotiate with? So yes, people would obviously know that peace was taking the officer hostage and trying to use them as bargaining chips to achieve your objectives.
So the hostages that were taken, there were, I think, 12 initially, but then some were released, and then...
Because like I say, nobody wanted to see any hostage or anyone being harmed. So when people was exited, when the guards was harmed, they released them without any strings attached. They didn't ask for anything for it. They wanted them to get medical attention immediately. So yes, one of the things we did was release false hostages from the beginning. What was intended to be a peaceful protest ended up turning into a full-scale rebellion.
Hassan says his peaceful protest was hijacked. The result? A full-scale rebellion.
There was a group of people, they became known in transcripts and stuff I've read as the Death Squad. They was going around killing people during the initial part of the uprising.
Tell me if I've got this right or not, but I read that you wanted to put these people who were alleged snitches in cells, locked in cells for their own safety. Is that true?
Yes. In the beginning, when people were talking about killing the snitches, I said, man, killing the snitches is like killing all the homosexuals. You're going to have bodies all over this place. No, if you feel they snitches and you're concerned about them seeing you do something, but just lock them up in their cell and they won't be running around the institution. So people was being locked up in L6 for their protection. You know, so that's the moment that you're talking about. But then when I left from this area and went to the body shop, and was talking to some Muslims, it was about 45 minutes an hour. I said, man, you know they're down there killing the snitches?
So the plan is for this nonviolent protest. When you see what is unfolding, I mean, were you freaking out? I mean, because it wasn't what you wanted, right? And then all
you know,
of this...
One of the brothers told me, said, man, you need to sit down. You're like having a panic attack. One of the Muslim brothers, Cummins was over security, and he appointed some of the brothers to take me in the room and let me relax. He said, look, we got this. Just go relax a few minutes, man. They're like, you're having a panic attack. So if that's what you mean by freaking out, then yes. I said, well, hold on. Go get some of the brothers. Go get some of the brothers on security and tell them I said, meet me back in the body shop. So they met back in the body shop. It was about 15, 20 Muslims. They had all different types of weapons, et cetera. And we was on our way going toward L6. Some kind of way, the people that was down, they murdering the people in L6 had heard that we was coming, and they ran out on the recreation yard. And when myself and other Muslim came into L6, we seen people, and people was gagging for air, and I told people to get him out and get some of these other guys out. So they took them to the recreation yard, and some of them actually survived.
Three men survived their beatings. Andre Stockton was one of them. You met him in the last episode. The rest of the Death Squad's victims in L6 did not survive.
And what happened was people were saying that the majority of the people that was killed was white. So now whites felt a sense of fear as if it was a racial thing, and we knew it was not racial. It was never intended to be a right to, uprising to begin with, and everything was real jittery, and people was feeling uncomfortable. So I think the uprising happened around 3 o'clock or close to 3 o'clock. So maybe by 8:30, Stanley coming, he got on the bullhorn and said, look, we're getting ready to say our prayers, and we ask that y'all be... hold on the noise, so give us the respect that we would give y'all, and while we say our prayers. And after we got through, Stanley Cummins got on the bullhorn again, and he said that if anybody, Christian, Jews, or whatever your religious nomination, if y'all want to come down here and pray, y'all can come down here in the same area that we use and pray. And he also requested that they give... the other people that came down, the same respect that they gave the Muslim, being quiet while they're praying. And that was like the icing on the cake that broke up a lot of the tension.
From that point on, the three main groups, previous enemies, remember, the Sunni Muslims, the Aryan Brotherhood, and the Black Gangster Disciples, put their differences aside and formed a common bond with each other, against the prison administration.
So as the days are dragging on, what are you thinking?
I didn't think it was going well. I think the prison authorities was trying their darn best in their mind for good reasons to use stall tactics, trying to get their officers back without having to give up a whole lot. And prisoners was not willing to do that because we understood if there was no hostages, they would have stoned the place a long time ago, and people would have been murdered and seriously injured, and it was not going too well.
Then, as we know by now, things took a major turn on Thursday the 15th.
How did things change after Vallandigham was killed?
Once Vallandigham's body was placed on the recreation yard, it kind of speed up the process. The prison authorities now start trying to operate or negotiate in good faith.
Eventually, negotiator Nikki Schwartz was brought in. Then, 3 days later, the uprising finally ended.
How did you feel when it was over?
I mean, relieved. I felt it could have been over a lot much sooner, but obviously felt relieved.
Hassan's relief was short-lived.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I continue my conversation with the former imam at Lucasville, Sadiq Abdullah Hassan.
So the investigation is led by the Ohio State Highway Patrol. Talk to me about being interviewed.
I was never interviewed once, not because I refused. They never even attempted to interview me. They had already set in their mind that I was going to be used as a scapegoat. They'd already decided to point the finger at me. So I never spoke to them once, I never refused to speak to them, and they never made an attempt to speak to me.
Hassan says he was never interviewed by the Ohio State Highway Patrol, so his name would not be on that list of interviews they conducted. I checked the index, and he's right. Someone else's name is also not on that list. Jason Robb, one of the other so-called leaders during the uprising.
Jason Robb's name isn't in here either.
Right. He said the same thing with him. So I guess me and him was in the same boat, being two leaders of sports person doing the uprising, that they had no intentions of coming to talk to us. They already decided that they was going to make us the scapegoat.
James Ware's name is also nowhere on that list of interviews. He's another one of the so-called Lucasville Five, the five men sentenced to death for their alleged crimes in the uprising. So these three guys who have been sentenced to death were never interviewed by investigators.
So many of these interviews weren't recorded. Why not record them? Why pick and choose when to record these interviews?
Exactly. When someone's saying something that you want to hear, then you want to play the recording and make it seem like you just stopped it. But no, you already had a conversation with them an hour, 2 hours, or 2 days before, and now you already know what they're going to say, but you're not going to play something not knowing what they're going to say. So you only want to receive the information that is favorable.
By the way, George Skates, maybe the most front and center spokesperson for the prisoners during the uprising, also currently on death row, was only interviewed twice by investigators, and neither one of those interviews were recorded. Is it just me? Or does that seem strange?
What were you charged with?
I was charged with 15 charges. I can't remember all of them, but I know I was charged with 2 counts of capital murder, one with regard to Officer Vallandigham, another with regards to an inmate by the name of Bruce Harris. He was murdered on the last day, the day of surrender.
Did you have anything to do with Officer Vallandigham's death?
No, absolutely not. He was an officer that used to be in my block. He was a nice person. In fact, he was the most nicest one of all the officers there.
Hassan says as he prepared to go to trial, one of the biggest issues he faced had to do with his representation. His two original attorneys, Rick Kerger and Charles Boss, basically told the judge that they could not, with what time and money they were allotted, properly represent Hassan. In time, they were replaced with two other attorneys out of Cincinnati. In January of 1996, after two changes of venue, Hassan goes on trial in Hamilton County, Ohio.
And what was the makeup of your jury?
11 whites and one black on my jury, a black guy. And even the state tried to remove him from my case, but the judge refused to do so because he know based on the case come out of Kentucky about removing blacks from jury, I would end up probably getting a reversal.
Sounds a bit familiar. Hassan's jury was made up of 11 whites and one black. Keith's jury was all white. Then there's something else Hassan brings up that I know I've heard before. Alleged issues with exculpatory evidence.
In my trial, the state said, Your Honor, we're not aware of any exculpatory information for this particular defendant. But the judge said it's not about whether you're aware or not. You have to go into the record files and see if there's any exculpatory information, because if it come out later on that there is, the case can end up being dismissed for lack of of revealing this exculpatory information. So we had another pre-trial hearing maybe 60 or 90 days later, and my prosecutor said, Your Honor, we searched the file and there is no exculpatory information.
What physical evidence did they have against you?
Absolutely none. No physical evidence.
So, if there's no physical evidence against you, what did the state have?
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I continue my conversation with Sadiq Abdullah Hassan. So, if there's no physical evidence against you, what did the state have?
Self-serving inmates who gave testimony, more or less took themselves, deflected attention from themselves and placed the blame on myself. The fact that I was the spiritual leader of the Muslims, and being the leader, I guess, in their mind, I becomes my brother keeper. So they relied on the testimony of Anthony Neville, Roger Snodgrass.
All people who got deals.
All people who got deals, right. Snodgrass said he participated in murders, he kidnapped guards, and a lot of those cases he was not charged with. Anthony Neville was charged with the guards' murder, but he turned state and said what the state wanted him to say.
Anthony Lavelle and Roger Snodgrass reportedly both took plea bargains and were released from prison many years ago. I've tried finding both men, but haven't had any luck. Interestingly enough, though, Roger Snodgrass in 2016 did participate in the Netflix show Captive.
I know I snitched. I gave up information on guys to the authorities, right? It makes no difference to me if you're judging me and you're judging me, you judge you, and anybody else wants to judge me for it, fine, man, judge me, all right? Put yourself in my shoes and, you know, see how you handle that situation, all right? I don't think most people would still have enough mind to be sane after all the shit that I've seen and done and been through in that fucking riot, all You know? That's how I feel, man.
And one more thing about Anthony Lavelle. He was allegedly the leader of the Black Gangster Disciples, one of the three groups in charge during the uprising. Hassan just said a minute ago that Lavelle cooperated with the authorities and in turn got some sort of deal. Well, what I find curious is that of the five people sitting on death row, no one from the Black Gangster Disciples is there. How did that happen? How is it that they are the only ones of the three groups in charge that managed to avoid being sent to death row? Could their alleged participation, like Anthony Lavelle's, have anything to do with it? Then there's Kenneth Law. That's another name you haven't heard before.
He said that myself and James were the one that actually had the officer murdered. I gave James Ware the order, but that's not physical evidence. That's based on hearsay. And the deal they made with Kenneth Law, that he must testify to the truth of his statement. If he deviate away from his statement, then they was going to reindict him. They gave him a polygraph test. He failed the polygraph test saying that he was telling a blatant lie. But nevertheless, myself and others was convicted based on his testimony.
Did Kenneth Law end up recanting?
Yes, after the fact. But, you know, recantation, there's many cases all throughout the United States where people try to recant, and the prosecutor would challenge it, saying the original statement is the truth and the recantation is a lie. But no, his recantation is not a lie.
In an affidavit from March 9th, 2000, and referring to the trials of Hassan and James Ware, Kenneth Law said, quote, "I was interviewed several times before both trials and was told what to say." Kenneth Law, who was convicted of kidnapping Officer Vallandigham and pled guilty to conspiracy to commit murder in his death, is currently still incarcerated at Northeast Ohio Correctional Center. His next parole hearing is scheduled for November of 2025.
The truth is they don't know who killed Vallandigham, and all they was interested in is putting the blame at the doorsteps of the leaders or people who were sports person trying to bring about a peace of surrender to the Lucasville uprising.
In addition to Officer Vallandigham's murder, Hassan was also charged with Bruce Harris's murder. Bruce Harris was believed to have been killed on the last day of the uprising. Hassan says he didn't kill Bruce Harris, and on that last day, during the surrender, there's proof of it.
There's a video showing myself, Nikki Sports, Jason Robb, Anthony Lavelle, and some of the Muslim representatives came from Columbus, Ohio, actually on the recreation yard. So once again, the state put on perjury testimony. They allowed prisoners to say that I was present when Bruce Harris was being murdered. But when you look at the video, I was actually on the yard. So I was acquitted of that particular charge.
Hassan was acquitted of killing Bruce Harris, as well as one count of felonious assault. He was found guilty and sentenced 66 to 95 years for attempted murder, two kidnappings, felonious assault, and robbery. And as we already know by now, he was given the death penalty for the murder of Officer Vallandigham. I reached out to the two prosecutors in Hassan's original trial, Gerald Krumpelbeck and Rick Gibson. If Rick Gibson's name sounds familiar, that's because he was also one of the prosecutors in Jeffrey Wolgenstahl's case, which we talked about in Episode 7. Anyway, I reached out to Gibson and Krumpelbeck to see if they'd be willing to talk with me about Hassan's case, but neither of them have responded. Today, some 27 years since Hassan was convicted and sent to death row, his attorneys are still fighting to get him a new trial. Hassan says he was granted an evidentiary hearing based on three claims having to do with ineffective assistance of counsel.
Claim 8 deals with ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to thoroughly investigate my case and call witnesses that could have testified to my actual innocence or could have challenged the state case. The other one, claim 9, would have been ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to thoroughly cross-examine the witnesses that the state called to the scene. And 31 deals with ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to investigate my upbringing, childhood, for the purpose of mitigation.
And those are just three of the many claims Hassan is raising. Depending on the outcome of that evidentiary hearing, Hassan could be granted a new trial. Until then, because Hassan's case is still pending, no execution date has been set. Unlike Keith, who is sentenced to die on November 16th, 2023. I decide to circle back to see if Hassan might be open to answering some questions I still have about Keith. This time, I jump right in.
Did you see him inside L6 or the L block during the uprising, in those early minutes and hours of the uprising?
Not that I can recall, no.
Lewis Jones testified at Keith's trial something to the effect of, like, they came inside, you know, early on of the uprising to check on their belongings. They saw that stuff was going on. He said Keith asked for permission to kill the snitches. And then, you know, if we kill the snitches, will you let us go? Does any of that sound familiar to you at all?
No, I was not around. Remember, like I say, remember I told you when they start killing snitches, I was in the barber shop talking to some brothers. And that's when some people, Muslims, came and told me that they down in L6, and they down there killing the guys that you put in the cell, snitches.
Yeah.
And I told the brothers, well, go get some of the brothers on security and tell them to meet me down there. And we was talked for about a minute and we started walking. And yes, people heard we was coming. And whoever it was that was in L6 doing the killing, the death squad, what they became known by, whoever they were, they had exited on a recreation yard. So I didn't get to see who they were.
So they were already gone by the time you made it over to L6.
Yes.
And
correct.
So when you got to L6 and you saw the people that you wanted put away for safekeeping had been murdered, what did you think?
I want to know, how did they get in here? Who let them in?
Yeah. And did you hear any names mentioned about who might have done these killings?
Yeah, I hear names, but not that I'm trying to conceal anything from you. It would be hearsay, and I don't have any firsthand knowledge, only what I heard.
Right. You know, a lot of people came out and said Keith was the leader of the death squad. And if you, the imam, you know, was the person who said these people need to be put away for safekeeping, who's Keith to come in and say, well, no, open the cells, I'm going to kill them? I wonder how he would have that kind of power.
Right. Actually, he wouldn't have that power. The only way somebody, I guess you could say, had that power or was given that power, that would have had to been done through a Muslim. A Muslim misunderstood someone's order. A Muslim said, forget them. Are they not Muslim? I ain't concerned about these guys, and allowed them in. Because there were a Muslim that was actually chastised about why you let these guys in this block. They just opened the door for me to go. I'm on the range, so they let the port out, so I'm getting ready to go back to my cell because I've been out 2.5 hours.
And just like that, our time is up and Hassan has to go. I have a few more questions, so we speak one more time.
Do you have any regrets, or is there anything now looking back that you wish you had done differently?
No, because I did everything that I possibly could. The problem is not within the Muslims. The problem was within the warden. So, no, I don't have any regrets.
What would you want to say to the investigators or to the prosecutors who tried your case for the state?
I mean, there's nothing to say with them because when people already made up their mind to do something, because in many cases, especially high-profile cases, prosecutors are not trying to seek justice. They are more or less trying to do something to boost their political career. And when you look at it, when it comes to the Lucas Hill uprising, I know prosecutors who have become judges, like Daniel Hogan, and he's a judge now for Franklin County. They have put their kids through college. They have paid off all their mortgages. Those people doesn't have a conscience. So there's nothing to really say to them. I mean, it would be a waste of my breath.
Rick Kerger, one of Hassan's original attorneys who didn't end up trying his case, was interviewed for D. Jones's 2013 documentary called The Great Incarcerator. And what Rick Kerger said in it kind of seems to sum it all up.
I don't know what justice is. I mean, God may know what justice is, but I do know what's fair. Did we give a fair opportunity for Hassan and the others to defend themselves? And the answer is we didn't. There was a huge thumb on the scales of justice, and if we can do that to them, then they, whoever run the system, can do it to you and me.
Next time on The Real Killer.
There's a lot of reasons for people to be against the death penalty.
We take a hard look at capital punishment in Ohio. You may be surprised at who's coming together to try and end it.
Technically, you could shoot them or hang them. But I have a strange feeling the people of Ohio aren't going to like either.
Please check out at The Real Killer on Instagram for some never-before-seen photos and documents. Also, if you're so inclined, leave us a 5-star review. Reviews increase the odds that other listeners like you will find us. The Real Killer is a production of AYR Media and iHeartRadio, hosted by me, Leah Rothman. Executive producers Leah Rothman and Aliza Rosen for AYR Media. Written by Leah Rothman. Executive producer Paulina Williams. Senior Associate Producer Jill Pescheznik. Coordinators George Pham and Milena Krajewski. Editing and sound design by Cameron Taggy. Mixed and mastered by Cameron Taggy. Audio engineering by Matt Jacobson. Studio engineering by Jay Brannon. Legal counsel for AYR Media, Gianni Douglas. Executive producer for iHeartRadio, Maya Howard.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.